Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. On this very special episode, I spoke to Catriona McCall. You might know her from things like The Beyond or Lady Oscar. That's pretty much what I talked to her about. Also with a little bit of Hawk the Slayer thrown in there for good measure. I figured there was no better time to release this episode than this week when we were talking about Jacques Demy's Umbrellas of Cherbourg. So if you haven't heard that episode, please definitely check that out. And in the meantime, enjoy this interview with Catriona McCall, a truly wonderful lady. I had heard that you started off your career as a dancer. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes, many years ago. And in fact, I live in France, as you probably know. My career as a dancer is what brought me to France, to the south of France, in a big city, the second biggest in France, called Marseille, which is a city with a bit of an edge to it even today. So that was quite exciting. After about 8 years of arduous training. But my dancing career certainly put me in good stead for everything that I've ever done on film and television, because it gave me an ease with my body and my body in space, if you see what I mean, in front of the camera. So I don't think when I was a dancer, I didn't know I was going to become an actress, even though it was my second love at the time. But I was concentrating on being a dancer. But little was I to know how much it would serve its purpose in front of the camera, certainly. So, yeah, it's all part of the story.
Now, did you move to France and then study there, or had you studied and then moved to France?
No, I had studied in London at probably the most important, the Royal Ballet School, which is like probably the most important ballet school, a bit like New York City Ballet School or something like that. And then it was a question of looking for a job, and most young dancers in those days had to leave British shores because there wasn't a great deal of opportunity within the companies that were in Britain. So most dancers went abroad first, and then they possibly came back to British dance companies. Yes, I guess it was all part of my destiny. I mean, I took to living in France pretty quickly, and it's a country that I've always loved. I was taken there fairly regularly on holiday when I was a child, because, of course, it's the first country across the channel where you might find some sunshine. So we'd had many happy sort of camping and caravanning holidays and renting villa holidays. So I guess I was given a love of France subconsciously by my parents on those holidays. And but I never expected to make my life in France. I thought that I would just work for a year, because I signed a contract for a year, and then I thought, well, we'll see if I like it, and then I signed the contract for a second year, so I spent 2 years living in the south of France, visiting a lot of wonderful places, and dancing in some of them. Then I got the relatively banal injury, which a lot of dancers get, an ankle injury, and kind of little by little that put paid to any pleasure I was getting out of it. It also made me have to make some decisions, which I then did. It put an end to my dancing career, and I then, luck had it that I met this French repertory company who were looking for a young person like me who could dance, female, you know, not an actress, because I wasn't an actress then, but I became one because they gave me a small part and I danced in the show, and that wasn't too painful for my ankle. And having spent more or less a year with that company, I then decided to concentrate all my efforts on acting without actually having been then to acting school, if you see what I'm saying. So I kind of fell into it at the deep end. But I swam and surfaced, and I then spent, that was also in the south of France, in a big city called Nice, which you've probably heard of or may even have been to, I don't know. So I spent 2 years with the dance company and then 2 years with the repertory company, playing bigger and bigger parts on stage each time. Before moving on from there, because I felt that it was time to move on, and I was kind of thinking of going back to England then, but I stopped in Paris on the way because I knew quite a lot of people who I'd been in contact with in the company, the theatre company, and one of them introduced me to an agent, and I started working on French television. Obviously, by then I was speaking pretty much fluent French, not quite as well as I speak it now, but pretty much fluent. So I was able to perform in French, which was a feat I'm pretty proud of even today, because there aren't that many. There are a few, like Miss Scott Thomas, Kristin Scott Thomas, who started her career in France. She's a couple of years younger than me, I think, a few years, but we were kind of around at the same time, and I remember people talking to me about her, saying, oh, and I still haven't met her. I've never met her, in fact. But now, of course, she's a huge international world star, and I've never had the pleasure of meeting her, but she had a kind of a similar beginning, and she's always, I think she still lives between France and London when she's not in America. Strangely enough, we even look a bit alike. People for years now have been saying to me, oh, do you know who you remind me of? And I would think, okay, go for it, who? And they would always say Kristin Scott Thomas, because we have the same British accent when we're talking French, and we have a sort of physical likeness. I always hoped I might be able to play her sister or something, but that has never happened. So anyway, that's that.
Can you tell me about some of your early roles? Did you start in television or just jump right into movies?
I started in television playing kind of, slightly smaller roles in short films. And then I'm trying to remember, my first break was in a kind of mini series, which they did rather differently time-wise in those days. It was sort of 3 hours of film split into an hour and a half on two nights running, and I played the young lead. So once I'd done that, I was beginning to play young leads and kind of make my space. And then I was given the lead role in a wonderful historical epic by a very famous French director who's now deceased, sadly, called Jacques Demy, and the movie was called Lady Oscar, and that was a sort of a big thing in France. We're talking about the late 70s now, really the late 70s, and it was a big thing at the time because he was a famous director from the French New Wave cinema, and he'd been given this contract to do this rather strange package of a French story that took place during the French Revolution in Versailles Palace and other palaces and places, with a English-speaking cast, a British cast. They decided to go for British actors in the end rather than Americans, and all shot in and around Paris, as I said, with a Japanese-French crew. So it was all a bit of a hodgepodge, but it was a terrific break for me in some ways and not in others. Terrific break because I was 23, I think, and it was the lead part, and it was this epic, and I was playing a boy during the French Revolution, based on a real character that had actually existed at that time. So it was kind of, sword and horseback riding, and it was terrific. After that, I got an English agent. The downside of that story was that the film only came out in Japan, so it has been shown ever since as part of retrospectives of that director's work, but it didn't have the, for various different distribution reasons, it didn't come out sort of worldwide, but it did certainly help me, but perhaps not quite to the extent that it could have done if it had come out worldwide. But then it would have had to have been a success for it to help me. And the year it was finished was the year where they brought out Coppola brought out Apocalypse Now, and they were into kind of much more realist type films. So I'm not absolutely sure that it would have been a huge cinema success anyway, but it certainly in Europe helped me. Let's put it like that.
That must have been something. You're relatively new to acting, and there you are being the lead in this Jacques Demy film.
Well, the reason I got that, one of the main reasons I got it, was not only, again, my dancing career helped no end, because I was having to jump on the horseback and do a duel with a sword, and I think if I hadn't had a dance training, that would have been a lot harder. But the the lead I'd been playing in the miniseries, that miniseries was directed by an ex-assistant director of Jacques Demy's. And Jacques Demy rang up one day in desperation saying, I've been to London, I've been to Hollywood, I cannot get all these Japanese producers to agree on an actress, and I don't know what to do because we've got to decide by the end of this week. And so it was Christian sort of right place at the right time as well. And hopefully my talent and all the rest. And so this assistant director, wonderful man, said, well, I think the actress you're looking for is standing right beside me and working with me at the moment. And Jacques Demy kind of said, oh, who's she? And he didn't know who I was. There was no reason for him to know. And I was packed off to Paris the next day on a train. And at the end of the first interview, Jacques sort of banged his fist on the table and all the Japanese producers came in. And he said, if Katrina doesn't do this film, I'm not doing it either. Literally said that. And I was the last one. I mean, they told me at the time that they'd seen something like, you know, several hundred people. I find it quite hard to believe that, but that's what they told me. Kind of hard to believe, but anyway, sometimes these things get embellished, you know, in this industry, sometimes more often than not. But anyway, he'd seen a lot of actresses, let's put it like that. And yeah, it was a wonderful experience, really wonderful, working in Versailles Palace, dressed in the costumes of the era, Marie Antoinette, Louis the 16th. People, sometimes the tourists thought they were seeing ghosts, you know. It was a great experience, certainly. And that was just kind of pre-Lucio, in fact. I mean, it was now for something completely different. It couldn't have been more different from the films I did with Lucio, which I, of course, thought nobody would see outside Italy. And so, therefore, I thought, a story I've told many, many times, I thought it was kind of okay to be in such what's it. The rest, because when I read the script, the rest wasn't in the script. The rest is Lucio, if you see what I mean, and his crew, of course, his lighting cameraman and everybody else. But that recipe, that Lucio recipe that those films proved to be, because obviously not all of Lucio's films were proved to be a recipe like that, but there was a magic somewhere which turned those films into a trilogy, which they weren't supposed to be originally, as you know. You know, it was just one film, and then Lucio said, and my agent said, oh, Lucio would like you to do another one, and I thought, do I really want to do another horror film? And then I thought, well, you know, I had such a good time doing the first one, because I did, and I so loved going to America for the first time, which a lot of, well, in fact, I don't think anybody I knew in those days, we're talking 35 years ago or more, about that, perhaps not quite that much, but anyway, somewhere between the 30 and 35 mark, you know, low-cost flights to America didn't really exist, so none of my friends had been to America then, so to go and spend 3 weeks, I think the first one was, what was it, Savannah, Georgia, and a few days in New York. It was incredibly exciting. And then follow that with 7 weeks in Rome, one of the blessed cities, you know. So who wouldn't say yes, really, and be paid, you know, if you were lucky, by Italian producers. I was paid. So that made it all the better. And so by the end of that film, I had quite a lot of friends in Rome. And when my agent asked me if I wanted to do another one, I again had no idea I was going to do a third one at that point in time, but I thought, well, you know, what else do I have to do at the moment? And I thought, well, I haven't got a lot going on at the moment. Well, let's go back and do another one. So that's how the second one took place. And then the third one, I sort of did standing on my head because I knew everybody. And as I said, I created a kind of life for myself in Rome then. I did contemplate at the end of those movies, because I got myself an Italian agent, a very good Italian agent. It actually didn't do me that much good because, you know, the Italian industry had sort of broken up by then, more or less. So there wasn't a lot going on for somebody like me, plus I didn't speak fluent Italian. Not that that would have necessarily mattered, as they dubbed everything, but I was already a foreign actress living in France and could get to England quite quickly that way. I thought, do I really need to complicate matters by moving to Rome? And I thought, no, I don't think I do. Not speaking fluent Italian, if they need a British English actress with some knowledge of Italian, they'll come and find me because I have an agent there. And sadly, nothing ever really came after that, yeah, which was a bit sad. But anyway, I mean, what wasn't sad was the success that these movies still have. You know, who would have guessed all these years later we'd still be talking about them more and more, in a way. It doesn't seem to be dwindling, the cult status of these films, from what I can tell.
When it comes to working on these Italian films, what was kind of the atmosphere like on set? Because I've heard that some sets could be very chaotic because everybody's speaking in different languages and they're shooting without sound. And then I've heard that others are very locked down. So what was that like for you?
I don't particularly remember the set being locked down. It seems to me there was always a lot of people around. I mean, yes, it was a bit chaotic. I mean, this is not a critique of the Italians, whom I adore, but they do have a chaotic side, and everybody tends to talk at once, and you think you're sort of actually in an Italian comedy rather than an Italian horror film. But everybody was really top class. So, you know, whatever they did it really well, and that reassured me. Plus, quite a few of the actors, the Italian actors, some of them were sons and daughters of famous Italian film stars or stage actors. So that made me think the second reason why this is all right to be doing this. If all these first-class technicians who've worked with Fellini or Antonioni or Visconti or whoever it is are doing these films, and sons and daughters of very well-known, respected Italian actors are in them, it must be okay to do them. So I would have said everyone got on with their job. Obviously, you know, Lucio was renowned for his tantrums, which he didn't have all the time by any means, but when he had one, he had one. And he was this extraordinarily complex character. I don't think I realized it at the time, but it was a bit like the Taming of Lucio, if you see what I mean. And I always said that he seemed to respect me from the beginning, from the very first interview that I had in this Italian, rather decadent palace where he saw me, which was actually his and then my agent's, because I joined that agent as well at one point. Abode, that's where the agent lived, but it was full of antiques and it was just something extraordinary. And right early on, Lucio was very Lucio, although of course I didn't know him very well in those days. And I didn't really get to know him that well either. But what I mean by that is that he was, surprisingly enough, a very shy man, despite the temper tantrums. So he was a bit of a contradiction in terms a lot of the time. But and of course, you know, I was concentrating on what I was doing in English, and some actors, yes, were speaking in Italian, but one knew what they were saying because one had learned the scene. And I suppose it was quite funny. If one had been there watching, it would have been quite amusing. I mean, what was funny was that, I do remember this, and this is on La Paura, Fear, first one. I remember being in the canteen of this slightly decrepit studio, which was about the only one that was functioning then, De Paoli's, which is, as the story goes, is now pretty famous because of all these movies. But it was kind of on its last legs, and I think it's closed now. And, you know, there was kind of, sometimes it was just as well we weren't doing real sound because it was sort of rain coming through the roof sometimes, and it clearly needed some money spending on it. But what was amusing was that in the canteen, during certainly a few weeks, there was me and Lucio and everybody and all the zombies and everything. And the other side of the canteen, there were people sort of walking around in angels' outfits on an Italian comedy, which actually turned out, the heroine of which turned out to be Isabella Rossellini. And she had Martin Scorsese running around. He actually had nothing to do with the movie, but they were together at the time. And so he was sort of there running out around after her. So it was, that would have been very amusing to film. You know, on one side, this Italian comedy with everybody sort of dressed as angels, and on the other side, Lucio and this very, very dark, violent though decadently poetic horror film going on, that created certainly a strange atmosphere. But, you know, we had a lot of fun on those movies because you had to have some light relief, because very often well, believed in what you were doing, and you were telling a story, however dark it was, is another matter, but you know, you did need some light relief, so a lot of joking would go on in between scenes with my leading men or whoever was there. And my leading men, were all three of them, were honestly really delightful. I didn't get to know Christopher George as well as I got to know the other two. Perhaps that was also partly to do with the fact that it was the first movie. Christopher was older than me, and he was incredibly professional in a very kind of Hollywood way, which I respected. So we both respected each other, and he was charming on set, but we didn't socialize a lot in between. Whereas David Wahlbeck fooled around most of the time, and so everything was a great lark and a laugh with David. And Paolo Malco, my husband in the third one, House Beside the Cemetery, was just a delight. He was a very intelligent, interesting man who I think had been an antique dealer or still had an antique shop in Milan. So, very cultivated man. And he was a personal friend of Lucio's. I think that's why he was in it. So I do remember a few dinners in Rome on Saturday nights when everybody was not too exhausted, with Lucio and Paolo. But you know, you work, as you know, you work incredibly hard on a film set, and you don't particularly feel like socializing with everybody, because you've got to get up so early, but apart from the weekends when you can, but you tend to want to meet other people because you're with them from morning till night anyway. And it's all very intense stuff.
I was amazed at how much you're on screen when it comes to something like The Beyond, where there are so few scenes where you're not in them. And that must have been quite a burden for you.
I didn't see it as a burden. And again, having been a ballet dancer, nothing's too much of a burden in comparison with the hardness of dancing, if you're classical dancing anyway. I just saw it as sort of getting on with my job, really. I guess I was, I don't know how aware I was until I saw the film that I was in. Well, I must have been because I read the script, but that I was in almost every scene. Now, whether that was a direct result of, because I'm not quite sure when Lucio and Dardano Sacchetti actually wrote it, whether they wrote it after, probably they did, because they didn't tell me, after the first one, and whether they wrote me into all of those scenes as a result of my performance in Fear. I'm not quite sure about that. It is perfectly possible, but I guess it's a compliment. And it's true that Lucio wasn't a terribly, what would I say, verbal director. He could be verbal at other times, but in his actual directing, if he was happy with it, he didn't really say a lot. I guess he was one, because I mean, I've worked with a lot of directors that don't say a lot, in actual fact, which again is a compliment, because it means they only say something if you're not doing what they want you to do. And one knows oneself if it's right or not, which is why one can ask to do another take oneself if one's not happy with it. Sometimes you're granted it, usually you are, especially if you're playing the lead. You're not granted it necessarily if you're not playing the lead, but you know what your performance was worth and if you're happy with it or not. And these films, I'm with The Beyond now, as we're talking about The Beyond, were a definite challenge in the sort of exploration of fear and darkness, and I was probably beginning to realize that I kind of could do it when I say without too much effort. I kind of had the hang of it, and I could kind of go into those depths without getting freaked out, because I felt terribly secure. At the end of the day, we were making a film, and everybody was very professional, and I wasn't asked, well, I was occasionally asked to do things I didn't want to do, but compared to most of the other people I had already read in the scripts when I first read the first one, and then The Beyond, that you know, I was the one running away from the evil. I wasn't the one who was having to spew out my guts or something like that. I wouldn't have played the parts because if I'd had to do that. As I said, you know, there's the famous worm scene. Everybody heard about that in Fear. And there's the famous coffin scene. That's also in Fear, isn't it? I'm trying to think what the awkward scenes were in the Beyond. I don't think there were too many, in actual fact. There's a guy falling off the ladder, but it was him falling off the ladder, not me. And he was such a lovely guy, Larry. I think that was the role. It's not his name in real life. And funny enough, I've just been put back in touch with him. He's delightful. Retired now. Can't quite remember where he's living. Florida, I think. And he sent me a really, really nice email 30-something years later because somebody put us in touch, yeah. So there were a lot of really nice, respectful people involved in these movies. I don't know that I remember it as that difficult. It was really more of a challenge rather than anything else, and I kind of enjoy a challenge, and I like everybody does, being able to win the challenge. And if Lucio was happy, which he seemed to be, then I was, and I trusted him, and I know he trusted me, and therefore I guess I felt I could go quite far with all of that.
Where in the chronology of things is Hawk the Slayer? Because it seems like that's coming out right around the same time that City of the Living Dead is coming out. Was that made before the Italian films, during that stretch, or how was that?
Oh, gosh, that's a very good question. I think it was before, I think. I don't think I had done, because, I mean, I'm trying to remember. When did Fear was it 19, when was Fear? 1980? 1980? Or 1981, I get them all in a muddle. Or maybe even before. Because they were kind of, in my mind, they were fairly back-to-back over a period of 2 years, it seems to me. I think I did one in April, then I must have done one the following winter, and then probably one again the following spring, or something like that. Yeah, I think that's... So it was probably, yeah, probably over a year and a half. So Hawk the Slayer, I think, was just before, it was after Lady Oscar, and just before Fear. Mm. That was fun, and that's the kind of, I mean, I never dreamt that would become a kind of cult movie as well. Sort of sword and sorcery movie. I mean, it was quite kind of simple, you know. I guess it wasn't in its time, you know, with this laser sword. It seems very simple now, but it's terribly sweet. I'm still very fond of it, and I got to work with the great Jack Palance, whom everybody was fairly terrified of on set. And he did look, you know, he was in a costume that was relatively similar to Darth Vader, so he was a very intimidating man anyway, but I do rather like trying to, when I say get in where others can't, you know, I remember the makeup artist was sort of terrified of Jack Palance, and I thought, what is there to be terrified of? You know, he's a human being after all. So I just went up and talked to him, and he was another, it seemed to me, rather shy person who needed, you know, helping to sort of let go a bit. But a terrific experience working with him. Yeah, definitely. Proud of that scene. And I remained in touch. I've kind of lost touch with him now. John Terry, who played the lead Hawk, for quite a while after that, because it just so happened that his cousin is still a very good friend of mine in England. So I occasionally hear news of him.
If memory serves, at least one, if not two or three of these films were thrown onto the so-called video nasties list.
Yes, indeed, yes.
How did that affect you?
Oh, that did affect me because, when I first agreed to do the first one, Fear, I had this conversation with my agent, and I said I was in Rome, and Lucio wanted my answer before I left Rome, and I was only there for 24 hours. And it was almost like Lucio had given me the part before I got there, which has never happened to me again on an audition. You go for the audition and you hope you get the part. You either get it or you don't. But I think I'd got it before I went there, which was rather strange. But anyway, so I rang my agent and I said, I've just read this script. it was, I feel rather mean, because Daldano Sacchetti is a very intelligent man, and Lucio, I think there were three of them that wrote it, but anyway, Lucio, Daldano, and this other person. You know, Daldano is a very well-dressed Italian gentleman and quite an intellectual of his kind, but I went around telling everybody how badly written this script was, because it was, it seemed to me, and probably even worse so because it was translated into rather bad English. And it was just a dialogue, really. There was really hardly any stage directions in it. So I rang up my agent and I said, I really don't think this is a very good idea if I do this. In other words, you know, it's your fault. You sent me here. What have you sent me into? And he just said at the time, he said, well, darling, have you got any other projects at the moment? Because everybody calls each other darling in that industry. And I said, well, not really. And he said, well, do you want to go to America? And I said, well, yeah, that would be nice. And he said, do you want to go to Rome afterwards? I said, yeah. It's the first time I've ever been to Rome. It's wonderful. And do you need the money? And I said, well, yes, of course I need the money. And he said, oh, just do it. No one will ever see it. So it was almost like he was giving me permission, and I needed his permission to be in this incredibly violent film. So I just did it because I thought no one was ever going to see it outside Italy. And in fact, boy, was I wrong, because I don't even know that the films were shown that much or are still shown very much in Italy, but they seem to be shown everywhere else. So here we are a few years later on in London in the early 80s, and my brother says to me, oh, there's this very important conference going on with this intimidating lady who was head of British censorship, film censorship in those days, and she was a kind of figurehead who nobody liked. She was a bit of a dragon, and I don't think there's been anybody quite like her since, in fact, and she was a kind of a subject of ridicule as well, but you know, she was powerful. My God, she was powerful. And so he just said to me, oh, well, she's presiding over this conference in this huge great conference hall. And he said, oh, they're discussing 10 films. And I said, oh, are they? And he said, yes, and they're all video nasties. And I said, oh, are they? And he said, yes, and you're starring in two of them. And I went, what? I couldn't believe it, and I was literally horrified. And kind of from that moment onwards, when I realized these films had left the shores of Italy and were being discussed as you know, films that were going to affect people badly, et cetera, et cetera, I decided to kind of hide from these films from that moment onwards. And so I never put them on my CV. I didn't talk about them for years, and I ran away from any journalist who got in touch with me. Well, I never let them get past my agent at the time. I just said, oh, just tell them, I don't want to talk to them. And was busy trying to be a serious young actress who, you know, would like and did do Shakespeare and other respectable things. And then a number of years after that, an English journalist, sort of specialist in the genre, just carried on and on and on, bugging me through my agent, until I said, oh God, look, I'll just let him meet me, and you know, that'll shut him up. And so we met in this pub in London, because I was in London, I was living in Paris at the time, but in London seeing my family and my agent there. And anyway, this journalist said, you don't know what's going on around these films, do you? I mean, probably talking about 15 years after I made them or something. And I said, no, what is going on? And he said, well, this is huge cult that's built up around them. Didn't you know? And I said, no, I didn't know, and I didn't really want to know. Anyway, so we ended up getting on incredibly well, and he seemed a harmless enough young man. And he said, there's this event going on at this very well-known and respected art house cinema in London this weekend. Why don't you come with me? It would be such a gas, because David Warbeck's going to be there, and David Warbeck's been doing all these conventions for a while, and he loves them. So I kind of tentatively said, well, will you hold my hand and take me there then? And he did, and I had an absolutely delightful time, A, seeing David again after all those years. It was when David was still on form. I don't think he was ill in those days. I certainly didn't show, anyway. And we had a wonderful afternoon, and I met the fans for the first time, English fans, British fans, and I realized that obviously there's always the odd one at one of these conventions who's a bit weird, but on the whole, everybody was just so delightful and charming that I thought, maybe it is all right to take these films back on board. And then I met, back in Paris, I met film producers who were seeing me for other parts and things, who, you know, I would see the poster of The Beyond behind their desk, and I would say, they knew who I was, and they said, oh yes, we really love those films. I mean, it was just amazing how many cultivated, intelligent, cinephile people, specialists in cinema, whatever they were, loved and still do those films. I mean, look at Quentin Tarantino. He's another one. So little by little, I got dragged in there and became kind of fascinated by everything that was going on around these films that I thought nobody would ever see. And it's kind of still the same today. You know, people still want to see them, and they do have this, even though they're very 80s, are they not? They do also have this kind of timeless quality to them, which I think is part of the draw.
The Beyond has that kind of surrealism to it that just takes it out of any kind of time for a while, which is fantastic.
Which is, you know, perhaps why they're lasting. And for a long time, I found it difficult to answer intelligent questions about, and give intelligent answers for that matter, about these films, because I hadn't really thought about them. You know, I'd only tried to think. I saw Fear in a small cinema in London, in the centre of London, on a Wednesday afternoon. I think it was the first showing. And I went with my brother and my mother, and I said, oh my God, you know, just cover your faces if it gets too frightening. And I myself, despite the fact I was in it, found myself covering my face because I just couldn't look at what was coming next. But, you know, there's only about 10 of us in the cinema on a rainy Wednesday afternoon. And I kind of came out of there thinking, oh my God, what have I done? You know, what have I done? Despite the fact that I thought that my performance, I didn't think I could really have done better, considering, you know, I wasn't ashamed of my performance. But anyway, it's a truly bizarre story, the whole thing. And here we are talking tonight, all these years later, and you're not the only one that I talk to. There are others. It just goes on and on. Quite extraordinary.
What have been some of your other favorite roles over the years to play?
Obviously, in latter years, some younger directors who've been influenced by the genre have approached me, and for example, there's a the film is one thing and the role is another in a way. There's a first film, beautifully photographed. Sometimes a little bit confusing, perhaps, but it was a first film, and he wanted to put everything in it because he was given quite a lot of money to do it. A young French director called Pascal Laugier, who did this film, which I think in English is called A House of Voices, Saint-Ange, it's called in French, a very Lucio-inspired French horror film. And I was very much playing this kind of sort of Jane Eyre type role, rather mysterious, rather hard. I greatly enjoyed playing that. Character roles, basically. As I've grown older, I have particularly enjoyed, nobody enjoys growing older particularly, but anyway, that's inevitable. And comes with that, if you're lucky enough, rather deeper, juicier parts, not just the young heroine who's got to look pretty and smile and do whatever she has to do. So recently, in fact, I think it's come out on DVD just in June recently, this again, French horror film, because these films were all shot in English, this Pascal Laugier, House of Voices, and this one I'm about to talk about called Horsehead by Romain Basset, a very talented young French director, about 30 years old. And again, another French horror film, very intelligent movie, beautifully shot again, beautifully acted by everybody. And I play this very neurotic, dark part with a big, huge family secret. And I loved that, yeah. I have to admit, I do, since I did the Lucio movies and since I reached a certain age and have a certain experience of life experiences, left good and bad, let's put it like that, I certainly am not scared of going to the darker corners of my soul and expressing them. And I seem to do it rather well from what everybody's told me. So, you know, it's hard to say which. Oh, I did enjoy, yes, I did a French, very good French TV series called, a few years ago, called, supposed to be called Mafioso. It was called Mafiosa because it's about this newly appointed head of the mafia in Corsica, who happens to be a woman, who's this young lawyer whose grandfather's the head of the mafia in Corsica, and the grandfather dies, and she's expected to take on the president of the mafia, so to speak. And anyway, I played this very tough American, would you believe, DEA agent with a gun, and I kind of, you know, based that on a lot of female American cops I've seen in movies. I love doing that too. It's great fun playing, you know, bad guys, bad girls as well. The badder the better, really. I mean, the things that are perhaps as far removed from oneself as possible, even though perhaps one could have been that person in a different life. You know what I mean? But those are the most fun, anyway. Things that you would never expect to play or even get near.
You know, one film that you were in that I don't think gets enough notice is one called Man Eaters.
Oh God, that. Yeah, totally forgotten about that. That's another one. Well, that was a quirky little movie. I mean, it's not perfect by any means, but it's a quirky little movie. I don't really know what's happened to it now. And I was trying to play that as a kind of strip cartoon character. Strip being the operative word sometimes, but no, as a strip cartoon character, and you know, and I thoroughly enjoyed playing that. That was great fun. Wow, great fun. It just wasn't perfect because I think it's really, really hard when a director has, I think it's really impossible, quite frankly, not to be recommended, written the movie, written himself the lead role, is playing the lead role, and is directing it on a relatively low budget. But, you know, we spent 2 months in Sierra Leone before the war there, obviously. I don't know that one could go there now, in fact, or would be advised to. I don't even know if it's possible these days. And, you know, we lived on a beach for 2 months. It was terrific. Yeah, a lot of fun. Lovely. But yes, I have done some weird ones. You're quite right, yeah. I don't know whether is that actually available on DVD these days?
Not that I'm aware of. I had to find a version of it that had Polish voiceover, and it was subtitled. Yeah, it was kind of crazy how it was just subtitled in English by a fan, and then with a Polish voiceover explaining what was happening to everything. Yeah.
Oh, well, that would take away a lot of the comedy, you know, that's for sure, you know. But, yeah, that was a fairly wild film, I have to admit. And, you know, it's funny again because I found myself, well, of course, you know, it was taken from a very successful little stage play in France that ran for years. It ran for years, and all these actresses, not me, but all these actresses went in and out of it, and it was a perfectly respectable stage play to be in, and a little sort of comedy theater type play. And then the same writer-director wanted to turn it into a movie. As I've just said, I'm not quite sure that it completely worked, but he probably could have done with some more outside influence, in actual fact. But anyway, I had a ball playing that part, and I found myself eating, because it was, you know, comic cannibalism, if that exists, not really, but that's what it was. Being married to, and then eventually eating, you know, my husband, who is a very renowned kind of theatre producer in England, and the son of an incredibly famous actor, stage actor, all very respectable. And in fact, him and I have we haven't seen each other for years, but we do keep in touch on Facebook because it was such an extraordinary experience to be in together. And again, we had a lot of laughs doing that too.
What have you been up to lately?
Well, I've been doing a bit of theatre recently with this English-speaking theatre company that I started 8 years ago here in the south of France. We have done a few dark ones. We did a play by Israel Horovitz called, it's a name like that, called Veronica's Room. I don't know if you know that play. A very, very dark, Lucio-orientated piece indeed, with a fantastic older female part. So I did that 2 years ago. This year we just did a comedy. We just did it in October. And I am involved in a wonderful little short film festival here, just near where I live, which takes place every November. It's been going for 22 years. And in the last 3 years ago, so I've done it for 3 years now, I was asked to organize a fantasy short film session for the festival. And it went down so well that I'm now doing it every year. It's kind of become integrated in the festival. And I have great fun doing that with a documentary maker friend of mine who's a bit of a specialist in the genre as well. And as a result of that, I've been in a couple of shorts, sort of horror kind of shorts. I don't know if you saw the anthology called The Theatre Bizarre, did you? Because I did that a few years ago. That's six international shorts, all in English, from different directors. What are they, Canadian, South African, English, American? Theatre Bizarre, yeah. And I was playing a witch in that. I always wanted to play a witch, and I finally got to do it. Very macabre witch again.
You're in the Richard Stanley part, is that right?
That's right, yeah. Who is another character who's quite a challenge, a bit like Lucio in a different way. But we got on very, very well. He's quite something, Richard.
Did you see that documentary about Dr. Moreau?
No, I really want to see it. No, everybody's told me about it, quite frankly.
Yeah, it's really good.
Apparently, and pretty funny as well, isn't it?
Yeah, very funny and sad,
yeah,
but more funny than sad.
Well, good. I'm glad for Richard's sake it's more funny than sad. Yes, I must see that one of these days. Yeah. Oh, he's one of those characters like Lucio you certainly don't forget. But we did get on very well. Again, you know, very well.
Thank you so much for your time today. This has been a real pleasure talking to you.
Oh, well, you're welcome. It's been a delight. Thank you for asking me.